Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription and or $29.95 for a full all-access subscription that gets you our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox. We've just finished our May issue with a mammoth magisterial piece on the question of whether there is a specifically Jewish conservatism, which will be of immense interest and provoke a lot of debate. Terrific piece by Tevi Troy on the healthcare meltdown. A lot of other stuff. Please take a look. Oh, Michael J. Lewis, the art professor at Williams College, writing really brilliantly about George W. Bush's painting. So take a look, commentarymagazine.com. The May issue is up. And this is our new podcast here on April 13th. And with me, as always, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And the question of the week, gentlemen, is this a new Donald Trump that we are seeing? So basically, over the course of the last week and a half, President Trump has completely vitiated the views and positions held by candidate Trump in a variety of areas. According to my count, we have a reversal of field on Syria, particularly as regards the strike against Bashar al-Assad's regime for its use of chemical weapons, a relaxing of the hostility toward China such that we are not going to declare China a currency manipulator, and the even more stunning relaxation of the hostility toward NATO, which candidate Trump said was expendable for no particular reason anybody could see. And then this week he affirmed NATO's centrality and importance and the history of its peacekeeping, and even signaled the possibility that he would support an expansion of NATO. This, of course, all being part and parcel of the new hard line that the regime that our regime is taking toward the Russian regime of Vladimir Putin. Once the hoped for reset, as Noah has written about extensively on the blog, the hoped for Russian reset of Trump times is now on the ash heap of history, and we are now back into realpolitik power games and the assertion that Russia is basically a bad actor in the world order. You don't like that stuff, or that's not enough for you? Trump signaled support for the continuance and the virtue of the Export-Import Bank, which has been a massive bugaboo to very conservative Republicans for the last 5 or 6 years, to such a degree that, in fact, in 2015, about 100 of them were willing to shut the government down in the House, were willing to take steps to shut the government down rather than if it were not defunded. So, and Trump said it was really good, it made money, it could make a lot more money, it's so important. That's not enough for you? How about the fact that he's decided to ditch his unrealistic tax plan and go back to the drawing board and design an entirely new one? And if that's not enough for you, we also have the phenomenon of the president's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, announcing a famous budget hawk, former one of the creators of the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives, saying that he wasn't so concerned about the deficit spending and the debt anymore because what we really needed was economic growth, thus sounding like a supply-sider, whereas Mulvaney was one of the people who was largely responsible or, you know, in some sense, significantly responsible for the budget deal of 2011 that saw the imposition of the sequester on defense spending as a form of triage against the growth of the federal debt. So
I got one more for you.
Oh, you got Noah? One more, yes.
This might be the most unkindest cut of all.
Okay.
It's the extension of opportunities in the education department to former Jeb Bush administration officials.
Oh, that's right. Yes, Betsy DeVos is hiring former officials in the Jeb Bush gubernatorial and presidential campaigns to help her run the education department. I got another for you. My former intern, Naomi Rao, a Bush administration person in the White House counsel's office in the George W. Bush administration is now the anti-regulatory czar in the White House. So all of
these are great, but specifically because to the extent that there were any substantive arguments made against Jeb Bush, they were on education and the expansion of the federal state-level governments.
That's right, because, of course, Jeb Bush was so terrible at education that he largely helped create the school choice movement and the charter school movement. So just terrible, terrible person. So, and this, of course, all dovetails with the question of whether or not the power of Steve Bannon, the former head of Breitbart and now White House counselor, that his star is eclipsed and that he's on the way out, and that, as I referred to him on a previous episode of his podcast, Dauphin-in-Law, Jared Kushner has now consolidating his power as the king of everything in the White House. So the real question here is, on most of these foreign policy matters, what we have is the discarding, or at least temporary or whatever, discarding of an entire set of assumptions that governed the Trump candidacy. And Abe Greenwald, you are looking at this and saying what? Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, right?
More or less, yeah. I mean, I may be a huge sucker, won't be the first, won't be the last, but I do sort of feel like something like a pivot has actually happened, because everything we're discussing, at least in the foreign policy realm, is cohesive. These are not one-off gestures. The change towards Syria, from saying Bashar Assad is someone we could work with, to calling him a monster and striking his air base. The change toward Russia and Putin. The praise for NATO. This is all of a piece. It's not like one script that he delivered well before a joint session of Congress and we can all sort of breathe easier. This seems real. And not to be too mushy about it, but there seems to be something when he speaks about these things, when Trump talks about these things, there seems to be something, dare I say, genuine or legitimate in the sense that he sort of didn't understand how all this worked before, and now there's sort of a light on. There's evidence of a dawning sense of reality.
Before I let Noah jump down your throat, let's explore this a little further.
Sure.
So, Trump runs a campaign in which he basically takes the view, as I think one could say, of a caller to the Rush Limbaugh or Mark Levin show on issue after issue. That is this kind of, here's what we should do. We should tell the Chinese they're enemies. We should make a deportation force and throw everybody back to their country. We should do this.
It's all so simple.
Right. It's very simple. Oh, they're all idiots and they're all doing it. Right. Okay. So then he becomes president and he's sitting in meeting after meeting, and it turns out that the world is more complicated. This is literally what he said about his meeting with Chinese Premier Xi, is he said, well, I had this idea that Xi could just tell the North Koreans to end their nuclear program, but he talked to me for 10 minutes, and it turns out it's a lot more complicated than I realized. Now, on the one hand, this is an extremely embarrassing thing to hear the President of the United States say, and God only knows what, you know, the Chinese Premier, who is, after all, wouldn't describe him as our primary antagonist, but he is the primary other power player on Earth, except for Putin, who really runs a country that is vastly smaller, vastly less important, and should be considered a vastly less powerful country than China, which is the largest and has the second largest economy in the world, and all of that. God only knows what this guy thinks as he's sitting across from somebody who can be convinced of the wrongness of his position in 10 minutes of conversation. Nonetheless, maybe there was something totally ingenuous about him saying, look, I thought this could happen so easily, but now I know differently, that we sort of have to take seriously, you know, that there is you know, some kind of, he's like Candide or something. You know, he's coming at all these threats. Oh, the world's more complicated than I thought. But if in fact that is genuine, then that's a positive, not a negative. No, well, Noah?
No, it's not a positive. Okay. It's terrifying. Okay. It's absolutely horrifying. Of course the Chinese position is, well, we can't do anything on North Korea because 3,000 years of history between the Chinese and the Koreans. And all of a sudden, 10 minutes later, you adopt their negotiating position? I'm sure it's genuine because nobody would so earnestly confess their naivete like that.
Okay, well, that's a good point. Abe, you want to... Do you have a rejoinder?
Yeah, sure, sure. I would say that it's positive to the extent that... Look, this he is the guy we have, right? So we already know that Trump is the president. We know his limitations, and we know how severe they are. Better that he sort of says earnestly, I'm learning. It's than to dismiss all incoming information as he had been and simply forge ahead with his bizarre out there ideas about the state of the world.
Okay, so here's what, let's go back to the campaign. So he kept making these statements that no one could understand. No one could understand why he was persisting with them, right? Because what help were they giving him? Except maybe he knew something we didn't. For example, the constant NATO bashing. Why would you bash NATO? Why is NATO unpopular? NATO is, you know, it's an alliance with Europe. Americans like Europe, as far as I know. Polling suggests that they... Americans do not have hostile feelings about European countries. The constant invocation of the virtues or the power politics virtues of Putin. Why would he do that? What was the purpose of it? As we can see now, you know, among other things, if it turns out that everything that happened between, you know, in 2016 was largely innocent, not that Putin wasn't trying to meddle in the elections, but that there was no Trump-Putin connection. One of the reasons a lot of people speculated that there was something untoward going on, or continue to speculate there was something untoward going on between Trump and Putin, is that it made absolutely no sense for Trump to be sort of plumping Putin up. Like, what possible advantage could that have? And similarly, you know, even though one could understand with China what might be popular about saying we should slap a 35% tariff on China, nonetheless, you know, once somebody says, well, you know, do you really want to do this? He just held to it. He wouldn't give up. He never gave an inch. He would advance these policies. In fact, he would push them further. And so one took him at his word to some extent that this is where his heart truly was. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe that this was just the Roy Cohn strategy, that the famous, notorious, despicable New York City lawyer who was his godfather in politics, taught him that you never apologize and you never back down and you never say you were wrong and you never look back, right? So that was the strategy that he pursued, and he ended up getting elected, so it was right. But he never meant it. He never meant any of it. I mean, and that it was only responsive. That is, he talked about it, and he was at these meetings, he was at these giant rallies and all over the place, and people roared and they screamed and they loved what he was saying, and he took feedback from the crowd, and now here he is president. He's not having these 25,000 person rallies, and so he's actually getting no feedback. And in fact, the only positive feedback that he was getting on these messages was from Steve Bannon, and he clearly seems to have decided that Steve Bannon is a net negative rather than a net positive.
And now he is getting positive feedback from the media. And despite his war with the press, I'm convinced he desperately wants to be loved by them. I think that's the source of his conflict with the press. And I think that will continue to serve as an inducement to stay on this somewhat more normal track, this tradition of American political action in the world.
So the comedy here, though, is that where he is defaulting on foreign policy is to a relatively conventional Republican semi-neocon view of the world as promulgated during the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, which was viewed by the media at the time and even now is invoked by the media as some kind of evil, horrible, low point in American foreign policy. So one can presume, I think, that though his pulling back from the brink of his extremist positions on foreign policy is right now being viewed as some kind of breath of fresh air or restoration of normality, it can't hold for very long that the panjandra of the media are going to continue to praise him for being moderate and middle of the road if he is holding positions that they found anathematic just 10 years ago. No, Noah? What do you think?
No, I think that's fair. And only because, from according to every administration official we've heard, their intention with these punitive strikes were to be a one-off, not a campaign. And they're on the hook now. This administration has intervened militarily against the Assad regime. The next time there's a massacre, there will be demands for him to respond in a similarly aggressive fashion. And it will be a far more costly operation because both Assad and his Iranian and Russian benefactors are resolved to exact a price for the next intervention. So it's a short-term gain. As far as Abe's theory goes, and I do think that it's what we are seeing now as far on the foreign front, NATO, Russia, Assad, China, it's all praiseworthy and it deserves to be praised. At the same time, I also see some resistance on people who think it's praiseworthy to note also why you went wrong, where you went wrong, and to address and to correct for mistakes, as though to do so would be to demonstrate insufficient zeal for the new Trump project. That's just not how you correct for bad behavior. First is to recognize it. I can't count on two hands the number of times we've said new Trump. New Trump has been like a thing forever, including two times in his presidency, the joint address to Congress and the announcement of Gorsuch. And I think you're both correct insofar as he seeks external validation, and he saw it from the press when he performed these strikes on the Assad regime. All reports we have say he's got a new bounce in his step and he's happy with his position now. And that's where my fear lies, is that external validation in Washington comes from two sources, the media and institutions. And that's where you have his support for the Export-Import Bank, his support for Janet Yellen's agenda, cooling off the economy, the dollar's too strong, that sort of thing, backing off his trade agenda. These are the sort of things that impress institutional interests inside the Beltway. And also what impresses institutional interests inside the Beltway is spending and big-ticket projects. And that's the next step. Because if the Bannon wing is out of ascendancy and the Jared Kushner Ivanka wing are, we're talking about conventional urban liberalism.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because the Bannon wing, Bannon was a big promoter and supporter of the giant infrastructure bill. Bannon said this is a historic opportunity at low interest rates to borrow money for nothing to rebuild our country with infrastructure.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the alternative here is conservatism. Conservatism was never an option.
Right.
It's just nationalist liberalism or urban populist, progressive, warm, fuzzy liberalism.
Well, the point I think you're trying to make is that the ascendancy of the Kushner subfamily, sort of like Frankie Five Angel, when Clemenza started his subfamily, and Frankie Five Angels in Godfather II became the mini Don of the Clemenza family, that the Jared Kushner mini family is going to push Trump to the left on domestic policy, whereas in fact I think it's fair to say that in the first 100 days or whatever it is, first 80 days, on domestic policy he's been fairly significantly right-wing on deregulation, on the Keystone Pipeline, on all of that stuff about energy and the EPA and various other things.
There's also, I think, there's another sort of big problem with your analysis, Noah. Everything that Trump has now done that constitutes this possible pivot in foreign policy, none of that is actually what warm, fuzzy liberalism has advocated. I mean, only since Trump came to office did liberals decide that they wanted a forward-leaning, aggressive stance toward Russia, toward Syria. These are not actually parts of the normal conservative foreign policy agenda.
Well, not the conservative foreign policy.
I mean the liberal
foreign agenda. Policy. Yeah. Well, they are now executing humanitarian strikes on Assad, taking a harsher line on Russia. I don't know
about that. There's plenty of people on the liberal. I mean, there's so a lot of Obama officials said, well, this was fine and necessary as a first step or something. But there's still a bunch of people on the sort of liberal left who remain totally skeptical and are like, oh my God, look what's happened. And he's using missiles. This is what we worried about. He's going to be belligerent and warlike. And,
right.
That's not happening in Congress. That's not happening.
No, I'm not talking about Congress. I'm talking about liberal. I'm talking about liberal public opinion.
And I'm talking about the people who are of influence to him. Like you said, he's not on the road anymore. To the extent he gets external validation, it's from the people around him who are constituting this beltway class of liberals who are hot and totally supportive of these strikes on Assad and totally supportive of a harsher line on Russia.
Well, we'll see.
That's the position of the
ultimately left. The real issue here is inconstancy. That is to say, why should one believe that any of this is represents a real pivot? I mean, it's a pivot, but you just like any pivot, pivots on a foot. You plant the other foot down and you go the other direction and you pivot some other way when it pleases you to pivot some other way. I don't think we can determine that this is a serious pivot without Noah's quid pro quo, which is that if what we did in Syria is all we do in Syria, then there was no pivot. There was some kind of a
spasm.
If it's a warning shot, then it has to be warning shots. You don't then go home and go away. You fire a warning shot and you remain in position ready to march unless the other guy retreats, right? So if, in fact, the warning shot doesn't work and Assad decides that he is going to test Trump's mettle by doing something else equally provocative, a failure to respond will indicate that what happened was an unserious rather than a serious act. The reason I think we can think that it might be a serious act is that it was designed by Secretary of Defense Mattis and presumably with some input from National Security Advisor McMaster. Both of these guys are very serious battlefield strategists and tacticians and are not in general inclined toward purely symbolic gestures of devil may care humanity, you know, devil may care making somebody feel better. It could have been that was option number three. That was the lowest option that they offered Trump, and he took the least risky option. But presumably they have more in store and they have more in hand. And I think we can also then step back and consider what's happened with Russia over the last week and a half. I mean, it's very, very striking that Rex Tillerson went to Russia, was not going to meet with Putin, intended not to meet with Putin, number one. Number two, Rex Tillerson, who doesn't seem to want to say much in public, said, we're seeing the end of the Assad regime. We are coming to the end of the time of Assad in Syria or something like that. That's a pretty startling thing to say in Russia. I mean, now, it could mean nothing. It could be a bluff. It could be just a sort of hot air. Or it could be an indication of something more serious. We don't know. And then, of course, looming over everything in foreign policy terms is the 800-pound gorilla, which is the question of the North Korean and North Korea and its nuclear capability and whether active measures need to be taken to degrade or destroy this project.
Right. And also that informs our discussion of what this cohesive change is all about. How much of all this is directed toward letting the North Koreans and China know that America is now serious about bad actors and them in particular.
The question is, we don't know what you need to do to be more serious. I would put it this way, which is that it could be that Trump is so unpredictable, and as he himself even tried to spell out somewhat inarticulately in the campaign, that being the sort of person that you don't know is impossible to predict his reaction to things has an effect that a negative or positive effect on deterring someone's forward action. Whereas if you're Barack Obama, you are probably going to have to do pretty wild and, you know, very large things as somebody who has promulgated a foreign policy so totally different and from a wing of American politics that does not believe in aggressive interventionism. You would have had to do something very serious to signal that your policy was changing, right? But Trump may not have to do that much to frighten the North Koreans. That would be the logic. Or Putin. And that I think the implicit logic of what happened in the last week, week and a half, is that in this weird Candide way, if you want to look at it that positively, or it's a weird thing to say about a 70-year-old man, that he's like a 16-year-old schoolboy, but that, you know, he's like, wow, he uses gas. That's terrible. Tell Putin should tell him to stop. Well, maybe Putin knew. I mean, the Russians are there. I mean, you think Assad didn't give him the heads up he was gonna hit the Erbil province? I mean, you know, he's their client. He must have told them. Gee, that's terrible. You know, they shouldn't be doing that. I mean, you know, and I've been so nice for so long.
I have a problem with all this.
Of course, go ahead. Please, I'm only spreading this to create a discussion.
Yeah, it was sort of predictable
point.
That there could, and this is why I have a huge problem with members of the Trump fan club saying that this our falling out of relations with Trump with Russia is something that they meant to do, as though this was all part of the plan. It was sort of predictable that you could have a falling out of relations between Moscow and Washington, in part because it was so obvious that Trump never understood what that dynamic was. He had a conspicuously good hold on what Russia's national interests are, vis-a-vis the near abroad, which it defines as the post-Soviet space, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. He had a very good idea of the fact that Russia defined this as a zero-sum game. Their gain was our loss, and vice versa. And by the way, it wouldn't be so bad if we were to retrench a little bit. And he exploited that and made it very clear with regard to Syria, Russia's involvement in Syria and attacking ISIS, which wasn't the case, but that's how he justified it. And also in Ukraine, where it wasn't really clear whether he had any interests, and also in the Baltics, where he openly flirted with not defending Estonia if it were to invoke the mutual defense provision of the NATO treaty. These are the sort of things that somebody who's got a pretty good hold on Russian national interests knows, and somebody who's a neophyte about this sort of stuff wouldn't even begin to understand how to express that sort of thing. So the notion that he was completely ignorant on this issue doesn't hold water. Now, to have turned about and embraced America's national interests vis-a-vis Russia as America's commander-in-chief, which is valuable, I think we should commend that, good for him, is nevertheless a point of contention, because we have the wheels in motion now in Russia to exploit the Trump presidency. Those conflicts exist, and we probably don't even know about all of them. So we've had a falling out of relations because...
You mean blackmail?
I mean that Putin has probably made maneuvers to exploit his newfound parameters of movement, his freedom of action in the Trump administration.
You mean blackmail?
How so? I'm not thinking that specifically.
No, I mean that somehow Putin has some ability to maneuver around Trump that we...
No. I'm thinking specifically about deployments, troop movements in the Middle East, deployments of naval assets in the Baltics and around in the North Atlantic.
Oh, okay. I thought you were actually saying, which I think is a perfectly... it's a wild but semi-legitimate point that Putin may think that not that the dossier that was published by BuzzFeed is correct, but that he has sufficient goods on people in and around Trump to threaten Trump with the exposure of embarrassing information should Trump step
out of
line.
The forward deployment of assets is not a cost-free proposition for Russia. It's very expensive.
Right.
They don't have a ton of money.
Right.
So that sort of thing is frustrating.
But no, I want to take issue with you again. I'm not convinced that Trump ever saw U.S.-Russia relations in terms of a zero-sum framework. He spoke about cooperation constantly, and I don't think that he thought America pulling back retrenching from Putin's sphere of interest or in the Middle East was ever to America's detriment either. I don't think he saw that as giving up something on our side for their gain. I thought it was a mutual gain.
Well, he was wrong. He also thought that somehow that, you know, we were being screwed by our treaty obligations that required us to do all this stuff that was of no good to the Trump voter in Ohio.
One of the things he said on Twitter today is that regarding Russia, that we'll have that everybody will come to their senses and we'll have a cooperative foreign policy at some point. And that's part of why we're in this position today, is that Obama, and to a lesser extent George W. Bush, and definitely Donald Trump, defined Russian interests without any input from Moscow, is that they sort of thought that any aggressive pursuit of its own national interests, a declining power with a closing window being aggressive in its own defense of its national interests, is not sane. And that sort of misunderstanding is frankly how we got to this place, this very suboptimal place.
Absolutely. And of course, the other thing is that, as I say, Russia is not a very powerful country. In fact, I mean, it's very large geographically. It has a lot of people and it has a large standing army. But the fact is, it's got the 30th largest economy in the world and is sinking. And the inaction of the United States in relation to the Russian near abroad, and the refusal, not really in Bush's time, because Bush did support the expansion of NATO to the Russian near abroad, but that the Obama's complete refusal of any sense of responsibility toward that part of the world. Indeed, the idea to play footsie with the Russians by removing missile defenses from Poland and the Czech Republic that were promised to them as a sign of his willingness or wish to have Russia play some kind of constructive role with him against Iran or with Iran. These things ended up emboldening Putin, who simply seized the moment of this withdrawal of American power to assert his national interest, particularly at a time in his own country when he needed some external diversion because his regime's finances and its position among the intelligentsia in Russia were collapsing. So he turned himself into a pan-Russian nationalist of a very old form and suggesting that Russia's greatness involved its expansion, which is something that has been thought for four centuries in Russia by different leaders. So in that sense, one of the reasons that people remain skeptical that there was no, or this is too many double negatives, that there remains an open question about what exactly was going on between the Trump campaign and Russia and Putin is, just as precisely as Noah laid out, there seemed to be quite an airtight case for Russia being promulgated in the Trump campaign's foreign policy that I think it's fair to say does not jibe particularly with all the other aspects of Trumpism, except to the extent that this weird American nationalism that he was championing seems to find some odd common ground with Putin. I'll give you an example of this. That is, in the paleocon world of nationalism, people liked Putin in part because he was so aggressively anti-homosexual. I mean, Pat Buchanan wrote columns in praise of Putin for having essentially an explicitly anti-homosexual social agenda, for example, that then suggested that he was he was against this Western decadence that was overtaking the West and looking for a purer, former approach to the family and things like that. So there's that.
Reflective of their ignorance about Russian society, they most on the alt-right will perceive Russia to be a defender of white Christian identity and attacking diversity for its own sake and restrictive of immigration and that sort of thing. Russia has a very open immigration policy. It solicits immigrants, particularly skilled immigrants. It's a very diverse society. It's one of the biggest Muslim nations on earth. And they've outlawed evangelism. Yeah. Evangelism is literally against the law.
Right. So we have this very strange, so there's that. And then there were some, then there were other, this other weird form of proto-paleoconservative isolationism, which was reflected in Trump's astounding statement to Bill O'Reilly on Super Bowl Day that, you know, what, we're so great? you know, that is that America has done all sorts of terrible things, and it's that it needs to atone for. So what are we going being so negative about Putin for killing journalists and killing his opponents? Like, America has no right to, you know, raise it high its moral standard. That is a classic right-wing isolationist position. Ted Galen Carpenter and Murray Rothbard and others who have promulgated this this view that is very ends up being surprisingly pro-Putin. So, you know, that's why I think you look at this and you say, well, what is going on here? And then, of course, we have the story this week of this peculiar person who was put on by Jeff Sessions, or somebody close to Jeff Sessions, on this Trump foreign policy advisory team that was summoned together in April of 2016 to make the claim that Trump had a serious foreign policy and that there were a lot of people in the foreign policy establishment who supported it. Many people on that list were obscure or third rate. And then there was this guy no one had ever heard of named Carter Page, right? And Carter Page is clearly some kind of either unknowing or totally complicit Russian agent of influence. And somebody put him on that panel, even though he never met Trump and he was a volunteer position and all of that. But, you know, here we are this week. And if you saw this quick interview with him that George Stephanopoulos did, I mean, one of the creepiest and most oleaginous people I've ever seen in my life. Who put him on that committee? Who was it that helped Trump formulate this airtight pro-Russian foreign policy idea in the campaign? Now, if it was this kind of weird paleocon wing that Bannon came to represent, even though he didn't join the campaign until August. By the way, it could have been the same people that got Paul Manafort, made Paul Manafort campaign manager. Or, you know, basically, there's Paul Manafort campaign. Paul Manafort is basically some kind, again, either implicit, explicit, or unknowing and foolish Russian agent of influence. He has to be 86th of the campaign in part because of this. Stuff coming out every day about him. So where did this come from? Now, if Trump is disposing of it, which I think is what Abe is saying, maybe you can say that it was not organic to him. Noah, you think that it was, but
I'm not sure if I think that it was. I mean, it was certainly organic conspicuous, to Trump, right? Yeah, it was certainly conspicuous. I mean, it's very hard to say what. I don't know how much he can distance himself from this, because now, after months of distancing from Page as being just this guy nobody really knew, who's kind of hanger on, now the Trump wing of the Republican Party, not Trump himself, but the Trump wing of the Republican Party, is embracing him, if only to demonstrate the correctness of his March 4th tweet regarding Barack Obama's wiretapping, because Page was apparently, the FBI sought a FISA warrant against Page and surveilled him because he was linked to agents in Moscow very directly. Perhaps working on their behalf. We don't know that for certain yet, but that was the implication. Manafort is retroactively registering as a foreign agent, having worked in the service of a pro-Russian Ukrainian regime. Flynn did the same thing, working for Turkey as a foreign agent, but also on the Russian payroll, which he refused to disclose. The guy surrounds himself with a lot of foreign agents for being, you know, an America First campaign.
I know, it's very striking. But if he is wholesale throwing it over the side, you got to say what's going on here. Part of it, look, what did he say about Manafort? He has now said the same thing about Manafort and Bannon, right? He's like, I don't know these guys. Right. I only met them. I mean, they were barely involved. I barely know the guys.
Right.
Which is, you know, I said, Manafort was his campaign manager for 4 months. Bannon was his campaign manager for 2 months, 3 months. You know, helped write his campaign, his convention speech, helped write his inaugural speech, prepared him, prepped him for debates. Was one of the two people running the campaign until the election.
So it's just conspicuous. I mean, I think it all probably, the simplest explanation is he seeks external validation. Whoever is telling him what he wants to hear in the moment is who he listens to and approves of. If it's Xi over some chocolate cake while they're launching missiles, it tells him, you know,
beautiful cake. Such a cake. You never saw such a cake.
Korea's really, Korea and China, we have a complex
delicious
relationship.
Yeah.
If it's the hardliners who were the only people who would give this guy the time of day in the early phase of the campaign, and now if it's Beltway insiders, industrialists, those who support the Export-Import Bank and the reduction of the power of the buying power of the dollar, it's whoever is telling him, you know, we need you and you're the savior on whom our cause relies in the moment. And that's why the Jared Kushner-Ivanka and nexus worries me, because we're going to be debating whether or not we're, you know, conservatism means the expansion of Medicare in a new entitlement state, because that's conventional liberalism, and that's the kind of thing that gets plaudits inside the Beltway.
I mean, I think the pivot, the change, is sort of less organically ideological than it ends up being. I don't know that he has had a deep rethink of how the world works, but I think he has had perhaps a deep rethink about what it means to be president. I mean, John, you had said a long time ago that what if when Trump gets to the White House, he realizes this is much bigger stakes than anything he's done. This is grander than all his hotels and than all his franchises and all. And he sort of grows into the bigness of it. Now, I don't know that that's happened, but it can't be lost on him that Bannon gutter fights his small ball, and now he's sort of instantly elevated himself above that. And if that comes with this ideological these ideological associations, so be it.
I will. I want to posit one final thought, which is that a seriously ironic thought, which is that for 30 years now, 35 years now, there has been a body of opinion in the United States, I think, that says American politics is too ideological. It's too ideological. It's really terrible. You know, you're either in this camp or in that camp, and it's so polarized and all of this. And what we need is a leader who is able to take issues as they come, one by one, make a decision about them. How do you feel about without regard to these categories and camps and things like that? And it's really, you know, he'll decide on things on the basis of the facts of the case and not a prior anything and this and that and the other thing. And this is where, you know, it's sort of like this notion on the West Wing, the TV show, that, you know, you pick one conservative Supreme Court justice and one liberal Supreme Court justice, and that's fair. And you do this, and that's fair, and you no labels, and you're not really... Okay, so we may actually now have this president who has no ideological compass and will come at these issues entirely fresh with no external historical precedent. How you like him now? This 30 years of nonsense, I was about to say something way worse right. than nonsense, about, oh, you know, people who really care about ideas and politics are really making things worse. It's just so much worse that they actually have developed views that you're able to understand and that cohere, either very liberal or very conservative, or even mildly liberal or mildly conservative, but they are consistent and they represent a worldview that means that you know when X, Y, or Z happens, your leader is generally going to view it in this light or in the other light, and can be criticized or praised for either by either his friends or his enemies.
I have a theory about that.
Yeah.
I have a theory that just about everybody who advanced that point of view was liberal at a time in which conservatism was in the ascendancy. And it was an argument in order for them to make the case for centrism, because in their minds, pragmatism never meant the compelling power of force directed by the state. But pragmatism means that. Pragmatism is the appeal to the use of force by the state, because there's nothing more pragmatic and solution-oriented than the use of governmental force.
Look,
so you mean the monopoly?
So they have an ideology that,
yes.
that would have restrained themselves, as do conservatism, which is an ideology which restrains you from appealing to the worst impulses of pragmatism. And it never occurred to them that real pragmatism is something no one ever really wants.
Well, look, who peddled this line more than anyone? Barack Obama. He perpetually positioned himself as taking the pragmatic middle that reasonable people on both sides would agree to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was his purple state nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, this was and it
but
was
of course,
all
he would frame the issue as this. It's
right.
like some people want us to live in the 13th century.
Exactly right.
And some people want us to live right. in the 25th century. But I disagree with both of those extremes.
Exactly. Yes, and
so it's like he would mischaracterize.
And you'll find most Americans agree with me on that.
Yeah. He had an ideological affinity, and most people who peddle that line do, and so they're restrained by their own ideology from appeals to the abuse of power, whereas the true pragmatist is not. It doesn't have any ideological compulsion not to appeal to force.
And then ultimately, the thing about having a fealty to a set of ideas is it not only constrains you, but it humbles you. In other words, you are not... Everything is not ab initio. You are not creating the universe of opinions and ideas about Syria for the first time, you are operating within a framework of ideas that go back to the very founding of Western civilization, and that some acquaintanceship with is supposed to have seasoned and flavored you and, yes, restrained you, because you understand the boundaries of the idea that you hold, and that they hold sway over you and constrain you. And you, part of your salesmanship, part of the act of putting yourself before an electorate, or, you know, a magazine putting itself before a readership, is to say, I will be loyal to these ideas. I'm not asking you to be loyal to me alone. I'm saying that I, like you, believe in a set of ideas that I will hew to, even if those ideas might be somewhat unpopular with some people, or will maybe cause me to do things that won't simply earn me praise from everybody. That's my compact with you as a democratic leader, that aligning yourself with a specific set of ideological predilections is a form of saying, I am not just simply going to act on my own as a semi-dictator, picking and choosing what positions I'm going to pick and things I'm going to impose on people, which is, I think, your point about pragmatism, that ultimately there's a vanity to pragmatism. It says, I can make all these, I can decide all this by myself without some of this is when people made fun of George W. Bush for praying so much and being a serious Christian and getting on his knees. Even that, if you think about it, is a form of personal restraint. That is to say, I may be the most powerful person on earth, but there is a force far more powerful than I who is my savior, my savior and my guide and my moral compass. And I express my loyalty, fealty, and belief in that above all, because I can't do this alone, and I am not the person who is, I'm not just creating myself every day. And that's the problem with Trump, is that he's obviously going to create himself every day.
And yet, most of the American public isn't very ideological. They probably don't really care how it gets done, as long as it gets done, whatever it is defined as in the moment. And that's why, to bring it all back around to the Bannon wing, there's this notion that's being peddled in the press by people who are ideological, populist, nationalist, supporters of the Trumpism, whatever it was defined as in the campaign, who are absolutely beside themselves and are shooting off warning shots over the bow of the USS Trump, saying, if you get rid of Bannon, you're going to lose your base. The base doesn't give a crap about Bannon. They don't care what happens to him. They don't even really probably affiliate really that much with Bannonism, whatever that is. They affiliate with Trump. And whatever Trump happens to be in the moment.
Or not. I mean, again, that's the question. If they're not very ideological, they may decide that Trump has their back. But one wonders if Trump talks conciliatorily about China for a year, are his people who love the idea that he was going to give it to the Chinese for stealing American jobs, are they going to remain so happy with him? Now, it may be that they'll say, well, that's what he really thinks, but he has to do this because that's the way he's really playing games. But I will conclude with this, which is that I think Abe has the better of this argument over you and me, Noah, in this one sense, which is that, you need to go under the surface to say what's going on here is false, right? So what's on the surface is Trump has said, what's going on in Syria is unacceptable. How Russia's behaving is unacceptable. I want to be in a more civil relationship with China. I like the Export-Import Bank. And I think NATO is a force for good, not for evil, or is in American interest and not against American interest. And if he's going to say those things, presuming that he doesn't mean them is perfectly fine, but it matters more that he says them than if he doesn't say them. And he needs to be given credit for saying them rather than not saying them, perhaps.
Okay. I accept that. Thank you.
So you win, yes. Even though I don't really believe what you just said. But okay. Because I do think it matters whether or not, you can have any real long-term faith that any of this is real.
Well, I do too, of course. And Noah's absolutely right that because this is a response to being praised, what happens when the praise ceases?
Or the other way around. Or what happens if the praise is so seductive that it
direction.
Leads you. It's like bread... It's breadcrumbs down the road right. to the
to Medicare
statist
expansion.
Witch's
and,
house.
Yes, yeah. A new unemployment benefit and all that fun stuff.
Although, remember, Bannon would have been for all that.
Like I said,
ultimately, Bannon would be for single
on the ballot.
Right.
It's just whether or not, look, we can, now the battle begins anew.
Right.
Now that the Bannon wing has been,
if it has.
Reduced, if it has, that battle obviously needs to be joined and finished. And then the mission to keep Trump from drifting too far to the left in the Kushner-Ivanka wing begins.
So right now he's in the Goldilocks zone.
Right.
We like where he is now.
Right. Well, we like where he is now unless he doesn't act to further that position. Anyway, so we need to let you get back to your daily lives and more important things like doing other more important things like listening to better, listening to some good music and calming down. So
Discussing United Airlines,
which we haven't gotten to, but if you want to see a good discussion of United Airlines, go to my column at NewYorkPost.com, NYPost.com, and you can read deep, deep thoughts on the cult, on the meaning of the cultural rot represented by the behavior of United Airlines. Anyway, I'm for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Keep the candle burning.